Welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. I'm your aptly named host and the podfather of your favorite hebdomadal podcast. We have a listener of the week, Deborah Elizabeth Finn. Deborah is moderator of Mission-Based Massachusetts, and she sent a lovely email to the group that she shared with me, saying that our 2026 Outlook show overcame her usual skepticism about forecasts. And she deeply respects Amy Sample Ward, our tech contributor, and Jean Takagi, our legal contributor. I should have said, quote, deeply respects them. So we overcame her skepticism on forecasts and outlooks. She loves our two esteemed contributors. And she even told Mission-Based Massachusetts that this podcast has, quote, outstanding guests, end quote. She said nothing about the lackluster host, which I'm grateful for. Thank you. Please leave that out. But I do thank you very much, Deborah Elizabeth Finn, for sharing Nonprofit Radio with Mission-Based Massachusetts, sharing it wherever you can. I'm always grateful. Deborah, thank you and congratulations on being our listener of the week. Oh, I'm glad you're with us. I'd be hit with asthenicoria if I saw that you missed this week's show. Here's our associate producer, Kate, with what's on the menu.
Hey, Tony and Deborah. I hope our listeners are hungry for put passion and fun into your fundraising. Ben Cooley brings his energy and warmth as he shares his thinking on intimate donor events, savvy stewardship, your major donor conversations, the critical role of leadership in fundraising, and a lot more. He is founder and CEO of Maxwell and Marie. On Tony's Take Two.
Active listening.
Here is put passion and fun into your fundraising.
It's my pleasure to welcome Ben Cooley to Nonprofit Radio. Ben is the founder and CEO of Maxwell and Marie, a boutique consultancy serving mission-driven organizations worldwide with almost 20 years of experience building, scaling, and leading high-impact nonprofits. He coaches charity CEOs, teams, and boards, supporting them to strengthen fundraising, clarify strategy, grow income, and increase influence. The company is at maxwellandmarie.co, and you'll find Ben on LinkedIn. Ben Cooley, welcome to Nonprofit Radio.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. Really appreciate it, Tony.
I'm glad you're with us in Nashville, Tennessee.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I know. Some people say to me when they hear me, when I get in an Uber, they go, "Where? Oh my gosh, I love your accent. Where are you from?" I tell them Texas.
Yeah. I don't know what it is about Americans with the British accent. I don't know.
I know.
Is this holdover from our colonial days? I don't know. Americans love the British accent. Why?
Tony, they do. In fact, I hate to say this, but I'll say it anyway. I get free Starbucks because of it. Because particularly in the South, in like Nashville, they're like, "Oh my gosh, I love your accent." And I'm like, "Oh well, what can you give me for free?"
I don't know. Yeah, you may as well take advantage. I don't know what it is about the British. I mean, I think Italian accents. I happen to think Italian accents are beautiful.
Yeah,
but I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what the origin story is for why we are just. I think they're overrated, frankly, British accents. I think it's overrated.
Well, I have to say I agree with you, Tony. I would think your problem is I'm going to benefit from it. You know what I mean? I'm one of those horrible people that's like, yeah, it's overrated. Well, I'll still take advantage.
Yeah, you may as well exploit the love. You feel the
100%.
Love. 100%. I just don't understand it. It's a phenomenon.
It's yearning for probably the days old, isn't it? You know, but there we go. I was once on a podcast and they said, I was in Nashville and they said to me, why are you here? Why are you here in America? What are you doing? I said, well, I'm here to make America Great Britain again. And they made me the hat, and I've worn that many times just for a joke on a party occasion.
I understand. Make America Great Britain again. All right, MAGBA. All right.
Yeah. Don't do it, though. Don't do that.
Yeah, no, we need to be our own. We are our own. I don't think we have any difficulty showing that we are. We are our own country. We are independent. We're celebrating 250 years of independence.
Come on, let's go.
All right. So you have some. You have a lot of good thoughts about fundraising, leadership's role in fundraising, but you have some concerns too about very recent press. So share what. I think a lot of people share your concerns, but for a little motivation, share what brings this to the surface for you.
Well, I mean, I founded an organization, a nonprofit. I grew it, scaled it to tens of millions revenue. I had over 35 offices globally, 12 countries, raised, you know, helped hundreds of thousands of people every year in the program, right? But so I take that kind of evaluated experience, and now, you know, sitting with lots and lots of chief executives of other charities that might be smaller, that might be more dependent on one income stream. One of the recent concerns that I've got, and I think everyone's got, is how governments are reshaping their giving, not only internationally through development funds. You know, we've seen that obviously with USAID and with other, the DFID and the new name for DFID and NORAD, and all of the kind of big institutional giving has shifted. But it's happening here federally as well. There are lots of nonprofits that are heavily reliant on government funding that are now going, actually, we were on that receivership and it was great while it lasted, multiple million-dollar you know, kind of contracts over multiple years, but now is the time to diversify your income streams. They've just recently announced how the shift within the Financial Times announced that there's going to be a shift from giving to nonprofits in developing countries and rather actually using the local governments to administrate those funds, which means several things. Actually, the way that income is happening now with nonprofits is dramatically changed if you are on the receiving end of governmental funding. And so it's, as an expert, one of the things that I did, I you know, like, I'm not just someone in theory that's raised millions. I've been there. I've done fundraising dinners. I've done over... myself, over 10,000 regular givers. I've built Christmas campaigns that have generated millions of dollars. You know, as someone that's been in this space for the last 20 years, I so desperately want people to diversify their income streams, because I've watched many of my favorite nonprofits that do great work actually suffer and have to lay off, shut down projects because they haven't invested in a diverse income stream and are heavily reliant on one or two of the incomes that they've got.
Well, for instance, you mentioned Christmas, the Christmas campaigns that you've run. That leads me to think about the reliance on events generally, you know, being too strong, too much dependence on event fundraising.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of organizations, you know, they do fundraising dinners. They try and raise, you know, try and get 200 people in a room, and you know, they spend $50, $60, you know, $1,000, if not more, on hosting those people. I think things have shifted. I don't think those events work as well as they do. I think they can work. I think if you have the ability to narrate the story well, and you're able to demonstrate activity for the organization and ultimately impact, I think they're the three things. If I'm looking at a nonprofit, you've got to have a great story. You've got to be able to tell what you've done with that. So how many people you've helped. And then ultimately, what has that help meant, right? I think at fundraising dinners, you can raise money. But what I'm seeing more and more locally is through the nonprofits I'm working with just in the last few years, where the real ROI has come is it's actually through small household events where you get like, we got the winner of some of my nonprofits that work with me at Maxwell and Marie. We've organized the winner of Hell's Kitchen, the chef, to come and cook. And it's been able to get the donors into a more intimate setting where you can not just present, but you can actually start walking alongside these donors. Because ultimately, I'll say this, the success of any nonprofit, particularly ones that heavily relies on high net worth individuals, your resources are in your relationships. And if you aren't building relationships, your greatest asset is the relationships that you have. And so these small local dinners are great things that you should be looking at. I used to probably do 20 or 30 of them a year for my nonprofit.
I love your summation of that your resources are in your relationships. I think that applies to nonprofits of any stripe, whether you whether you're cultivating high net worth individuals or more like our listeners in small and mid-sized nonprofits, you don't have those kinds of folks, but the resources are still in the relationships. Uh-huh. I absolutely agree with you too about small events. I love sort of not hosting them. I don't host them as a consultant, but I speak at them. And going into someone's home where maybe it's six or eight couples or something like that, you know, or even sometimes it's even just 10 or 12 people. Well, that 12 people is six couples. But small like that, you know, those intimate events, you really, I mean, the CEO can get to know folks. Maybe you bring someone from the program staff or, you know, who's on the ground. I mean, if it's at all animal related, maybe you can bring a couple of animals, or pets, potential pets, you know, that you really can move people in small groups. I'm not surprised to hear you say you have great success with, you know, 30 of those a year.
Yeah. And I think, you know, for me, you know, like I was working with a startup nonprofit first year of trading, and they did one of these dinners. They got 10 couples together and, they raised $50,000, you know, in one night because the founder had such a great narrative and story. And then I think the opportunity from there is then how do you steward those relationships, right? I say this phrase often, thanking equals banking, right? If you want the ability to bank another check, it's actually intrinsically linked to your donor thanking strategy. And how do you make them feel seen? How do you make them feel like they're not just on a conveyor belt? You know, I remember one time I phoned up, like I say, I ran quite a large operation, and I phoned up a donor that responded to one of the events that we did. We did this tour, and we were asking people to give $19 a month. And in that 10-day tour, we got 1,100 people respond to giving $19 a month. And I phoned one of them up. I was like, they'd seen me speak on the platform. I said, I just want to say thank you so much for giving $19 a month. You wouldn't believe the lives that are going to get changed because of your partnership, right? And they were like, what? The chief executive's phoning me up. I was like, yeah, because we're just, it's the heartbeat of our culture, right? Culture determines what you grow. And if you're not, if you don't at the top level demonstrate the gratitude for the raindrops that are coming in, that ultimately collect and make this tsunami of hope, right? If we're not grateful for the raindrops, then actually, what are we, you know, we're not being the leader that we should be, right? And so I was just demonstrating to my team and to our donors, you know, the fact that gratitude is at the heart of what we do. It's not entitlement. It's gratitude. And so I phoned this donor up, said, thanks so much. The donor was like, oh my God, I can't believe that you phoned us. This is amazing. They said, I feel so bad. I could give way more than $19 a month. Let me go and speak to my wife. I want to just go. We're going to get behind this charity because I've never been thanked by the chief executive. I was like, oh my God. So he goes back and he comes back to me, phones me up, and he says, look, you know, we're not going to give $19 a month. We're going to give $19,000 a month. I was like,
gosh.
Whoa. Yeah. Right. And I said to my team at the time, I said, look, you know, reality is people don't need to give to nonprofits. But when they feel the feeling of appreciation and you link that with a worthy cause, then the sky is the limit. We can do amazing things because people want, ultimately, once people get successful and they have finance, they go to the next era of what they're giving and what their life wants to do, which is success to significance. And so we have to be great orators of the fact that what they're doing is significant.
You know, I like to get into details and like action steps. So after this like glorious oration about stewardship and thanking, and I like to use the phrase effusive thanks. I like to give effusive thanks. But what are your, so let's drill down to some tips. Stewardship. Mm-hmm. I mean, how should we be showing this enormous gratitude mm-hmm. that we have? What do we need to make sure we're doing?
Right. You ready? Okay.
I'm ready. Listeners are ready. So, please.
I said to the admin team, to the donor, whatever size you are, right? Whatever department it is, right? That within 48 hours, they get a signed letter. I don't mean like just an email. I mean, print out a letter that articulates what this is going to achieve, that donation, whether it's for $5 a month, whether it's for $50 a month, $5,000 a month, that they get a letter that's signed by the chief executive, right, within 48 hours. Now, if it, you know, say if I was traveling, because I used to travel a lot, I say the most senior person in the office that's available, right?
Okay.
But within 48 hours, they get that. Within 1 week, they get a phone call that articulates gratitude, thank you, link them to what the mission is, right? They then get put on a 6-week campaign drip. I'm sorry, this is too practical. I apologize. But basically,
I forbid your apology.
Yeah,
stop.
Yeah. Well, okay, fine. But
it's practical. So practicality is what we want.
Okay, fine. So basically, week one, they get just a thank you email that's going to outline a story of a life that's going to be impacted. Week two is then going to be introducing them to the organization, the drip feed campaign, right? So it's going to be like, this is what we do. This is how we do it. This is, you know, this is the locations that we're in. It gets them, because a lot of people will give because of a story, but that story doesn't always demonstrate what the organization does. And so over the next two times, it's going to be an about us. If you have an about us video, put that in. If you have something that narrates the program and the impact, then week four, so week two and week three are about us emails, right? Week four is going to be financials. So you're going to demonstrate your financial integrity. You're going to go, look at us. We're on, you know, Charity Navigator. We've got 100% score on Charity Navigator. Why? Because we appreciate good governance. We appreciate this. We appreciate that. You know, we've got our right policies in place. It's a relatively boring email. But actually, for the people that are not heart givers, but are mind givers, right? So they're the people that sit in a room and going, well, if I gave you $1 million, what would you do with it? You know, not because you made me cry, here, have all my money. No, it's the people that are like, I want an ROI on this.
Yeah, these are more cerebral. What percentage of your revenue goes to the program?
Exactly.
The administration. Yeah. All right.
They are the people that have got their donor advised fund and they are going, I want an ROI on this. Or they are the people that are going to, you know, I don't know if you've heard of this new, I would encourage your listeners to look at them, but like the faith-driven investor movement. I don't know if you've heard of them. They're out of Dallas, Texas. And one of the things that they're really pointing people towards is compassionate investment. So basically they're saying, use your donation like it's an investment into your investment portfolio, right? So it means that actually week four is really important to those, right? Because they're going to look at it and go, you know, like they want to know, What's the percentage of that's spent on program versus administration? Now, Tony, I just want you to know to the listeners, I don't agree. I'm one of those people that disagrees with the 80-20 rule, right? I don't think it's possible, particularly for smaller organizations. I don't think it's possible, right? I
think the 80-20 being
80% spent on program.
Program, yeah.
20% spent on fundraising, media, admin, you know, all that sort of stuff. I don't think
that's
possible.
I don't think that's a hard rule, but I've heard it. Yeah.
All right. And so, and then the sixth is then celebration.
Wait a minute. Right? What happened to five? Wait, where'd we go five?
Four. Did we go five?
We did four. Sorry. We did three and four are about us.
Yeah.
Oh, that's five right. Is the cerebral. Five is for the more cerebral folks, your ROI. Okay, I'm sorry. Yes.
Yeah. The six is celebration, right? And it's literally just going organizational celebration moments that you can go with, like, that combines all of those tools. So it's a 6-week campaign. At the 6 week, then they get a phone call as well, right? And go, we're so grateful. We are so grateful. This you gave 6 weeks ago, and you give some form of update of what that donation has done, right? Then they get put into the normal kind of bog standard, and they get a phone call every year, and they get put through. Now, in that 6 week period, you will find that it's number one, you know, when people give to a regular giving campaign or they give one off, it's where their heightened awareness of you is, right? So like the husband, for example, might be checking the bank account and going, what's this large donation? Who's this for? You know, well, don't worry. They've been in touch. They've thanked us. They've done this. It's the greatest stress for a nonprofit when they get regular giving. It's the greatest stress point because it's where the highest amount of cancelled regular givers are, is in the first 6 weeks, right? Because you've got the first initial payment being taken, the second initial payment comes out. It's like, do they really want to be in? And the greatest stress for that factor is when you actually do sponsored events. I don't know if you've ever had anyone come on and talk about, like, when, you know, a Christian artist or an artist goes out and does those mass 3,000, 5,000 arenas, and they ask for the big boys of, you know, child sponsorship. Well, the greatest risk for those asks or the regular giving is actually in the first 6 weeks. So this kind of adds a kind of story, a narrative. They get a phone call at the end and then they get put into thing it. All the while, every single one of those emails, you're saying, thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
What's the leader's role, leadership role in fundraising? The C-suite, maybe the CEO certainly has a role, but board members, let's talk about leadership's role in fundraising.
Well, I say everyone's a fundraiser, right? And it's entirely true. I think actually some people in the organization probably aren't geared towards fundraising, but they can be geared towards friend raising. You know, if you go back to that principle, your resources are in your relationships, right? There are people that can introduce you to people, that can elevate, that can contribute, but everyone at least needs to be a fundraiser. But not everyone can be a fundraiser. But I would say everyone's a fundraiser, because if they can raise funds, like if they're in the program team, they're a social worker, and they're related to someone who's, you know, got a business that's doing really well, that's giving 10 million away, like, hello, we're here, you know, like. But reality is everyone should be looking to grow the database. And I think that's often overlooked, actually. I don't, you know, because it's fundraising is actually a metrics game. And a lot of small nonprofits are going, hey, you know, like, I just wish I had more people. I wish I, you know, had more money. I could do so much more good with this money. And you're dead right, you can. But if you're a smaller nonprofit, I'm talking like sub 500,000, maybe 100,000, 200,000, right at that part, you're doing great. I mean, not many nonprofits get to that stage, right? So good on you. Well done for all of the hard work, the labor that you've put into place. But what I would say to you now is do what you can to get as many people to just interact with your organization as possible. Go out and speak anywhere that will have you and have a mechanism to gather their data. Because ultimately, if I'm stood in front of a crowd, right, and I am allowed to ask them to support. So let's say if I get in front of 100 people, if I'm allowed to do a regular giving ask, my methodology, which I now teach, I can get, I've had up to 33% of people give in an auditorium with this methodology, right? So I was in front of 3,000 people in Norway when we launched our Norwegian office, and we got 998 people to give regularly. So it's a metrics game. So if you're only getting in front of, as a chief executive, if your diary or founder, if you're looking at your next 3 months and you've got no speaking engagements, you've got no podcast that you're speaking on, you've got no no activity that you're getting in front, I can pretty much guess what your outcome is going to be. So ultimately, you have to get busy in front of people to get that 4 to 13% of people to actually sign up to your mission and get behind your cause.
It's time for Tony's Take Two.
Thank you, Kate. I had the opportunity about 2 weeks ago to meet with a lot of staff, team members at a client. There are 20 people who I met with a couple of others. We had 20 30-minute meetings in 2 days. And that's a lot. That's a lot. But the value, what came out of it, I learned so much from these folks because I was really listening actively, intently, carefully. I was taking some notes, but I was mostly just listening to their tone. And you know, we were talking about what their goals are within the nonprofit, what they'd like to do, the challenges that they see, ways to overcome those kinds of challenges. It was just reinforcing for me, you know, the value of asking open-ended questions and just letting people talk and then me listening carefully. I came away with so much insightful, informative, like sort of data that will help me to help that client. So this certainly has implications for your fundraising, you know, when you're meeting with folks. So really, I'm just, just reinforcing something you probably already know, how valuable it is just being the listener, the careful listener, the active listener. You come away with learning so much. And that is Tony's Take Two. Kate?
Yeah, usually Uncle Tony is the one talking, so he doesn't get much practice listening.
I it's very good. I listen as much as possible. I mean, this is Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. I mean, I do have a role here.
Right. Talk show.
Associate producer. Soon to be assistant producer if you keep up this thread. Oh. By the way, assistant is below associate. I don't know if you're aware of that. You are aware. Okay. No, that's very good. Nicely played.
Oh, by the way, your brother was laughing in the background. I heard a quick little chuckle from him.
Yeah, well, he's not getting part of the revenue the way you do. There's no fee for him.
We've got buku buttloads more time. Here's the rest of Put Passion and Fun into Your Fundraising with Ben Cooley.
Now, what's this methodology you have that you alluded to that you're teaching, but
Tony,
you tease it, teases it, but then he doesn't flush it out.
Dude, Tony, get it out of me.
What's the methodology?
Right. So most nonprofits, when they speak at a church, right, or they speak at an event, they'll do the easiest, because no one likes asking for money. Can we just kind of put this principle out?
Yeah.
That no one really likes asking for money. And if you do, good on you. You're not part of the you're not part of the norm, right? So particularly founders, they feel embarrassed of the fact that they are asking for money, because often some of that money's going towards their salary, or, you know, it's covering some of the expenses and they feel embarrassed by it. And I get that. You know, I had a mentor of mine that developed a charity called Christians Against Poverty, right, in the UK. And they pride themselves of getting over, I think they were over 25,000 regular givers. He sat me down one time and the first thing I ever did, right, was I booked an arena in England. I got 5,884 people to my first event. And then I did a regular giving ask and it absolutely sucked. I got hardly anyone give, right? And he sat me down after this. He went, "You suck." I was like, "Thanks, bro. I really appreciate the encouragement." He said, "No, what you need to do is you need to stand on a platform and tell people, I'm going to ask you for money, but I really am really bad at this. So can we just all agree I'm bad, but the mission that we're doing is worth this ask, right?" So most nonprofits take the easiest out, right? And they go and they say, "Okay, guys, so please could you give? And if you just want to head back at the back table, I've got some flyers, you know, maybe you could give 4%, the maximum." I've done hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these events. You know, I'm not joking, right? I had, at any point in time, I had 70 trained speakers going out in churches and speaking in churches every Sunday, 70 trained speakers, right? So like I've aggregated all that data, 4%. If you send people to a table, this is what's going to happen. There's going to be a massive queue at that table, right? And they're going to go, then probably about seven people are going to be able to speak to you because one person wants to tell you that they are really moved by your charity and, oh my God, you know, like, and 7 days later, you're still talking to that same person. Right. And if you've got a British accent, it's longer. I don't know why. Anyway, so you'll get 4%. So if you've got 100 people, that means 4 people are going to give to you. If you've got 200 people, that's 8. Right. Then the next thing is this. If you're brave enough, you go and speak to the event host or the church pastor or whoever it is. Right. And you say, "Can we put the giving envelopes on the chairs?" Right. Well, you've just increased it to 9% by doing that, right?
Yeah.
You go, "Hey, give now. And everyone get the flyer. Oh, my gosh. Now, as I'm telling this story, fill it out," right? That's 9%. Now, if you want to get over 13%, it's going to be hard. And I'm not going to lie. This is not made for the faint of heart. I just want you to know this, right? QR codes, I'm not a big fan of. Every organization I've dealt with in the last 3 or 4 years that does QR codes, what happens is people get out the phone, they scan the QR code, and then they get a text from their daughter or from thingy, and they get distracted into work, right? I don't like that methodology. It might work for some, but I've not seen it with any of our clients, right?
All right.
Even at high net worth individual dinners, I don't rate it, right? Still in America, you guys have got something called checks. Like, and we got rid of those in the 1980s, guys. It was unbelievable. You know what I mean?
You live in Nashville, Tennessee. What we?
I know. Sorry. Yeah. Still use checks, and I still, every time I have to Google how to fill it out. Anyway, so.
Google how to fill it out.
Yeah, right. So 13%. If you want to get above 13%, this is what you do. Tony, this is what you do. And it's awful. You need volunteers for this. You need to be so organized, right? You basically, you pass the buckets down. You go, I'm going to do a regular giving ask right now. I'm going to ask you to partner with us on a monthly basis. We're going to have the team pass the buckets down the rows. This is not to put anything in, but this is actually to take the form out. Now, I used to run an anti-slavery organization, right? And it's almost like you are taking someone's life out of slavery right now. And now it adds a component to this because you get the decision. Psychology of giving, right, is you get the decision when the book is passing. Are you going to pass by on this opportunity, or are you going to be the person that's going to be the person that helps? And so suddenly, psychologically, you've just triggered them into not only themselves thinking that, but now they're also thinking, everyone else knows that I'm not taking it out. And so you get a higher percentage. And then what happens is you fill out the form normally, and then you pass the buckets back. So it's like super organized.
So what, what are they taking out of the bucket? A monthly
the regular giving form. Yeah.
A monthly sustainer giving commitment. Yeah. And then they pass it back somehow.
Yeah. Once you finish, you often play a video of a life being transformed, and then you get back up and you say, right, we're going to pass back the buckets, and you're going to put the envelopes in like you are putting your name, your family's name in this, saying, I'm in it to end it. Come on, are you with me? Say amen.
Okay.
And then you'll get a lot higher. And that's what it's interesting. It's why I'm so passionate about fundraising, because a lot of people put the energy into curating these events or these Christmas campaigns. But if they just had a little bit higher thinking or a little bit of a different technique, then actually they could go from one organization I work with was doing a Christmas campaign. They literally raised 20,000 in their Christmas campaigns. They're now hitting 200,000-300,000 because they're just tweaking it and doing different things, but those different things have different results.
What's with Maxwell and Marie, your company? Do they exist? Who are Maxwell and Marie? Or they exist? Or they what?
It's me and my wife. My wife started a nonprofit and I started one. And so we decided that we would do all of our experiences that we've done. We would put them together into a boutique consultancy. We don't work with a lot of organizations. We just work with a few that we think we can more than double in a 2 or 3 year period.
Well, where's your wife? She's not. Why didn't you pitch you and your wife talking as guests?
Wife, you should have her next time. But she is way better looking than me, and we have 10 children. So she's currently holding the 10 children back from invading this podcast right now. So yeah. So
you have 10 children in one house in one house.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Dang.
Yeah, it's a lot. I would say.
Yeah.
It's right. 20 years old all the way down to 7 months old.
All right, congratulations on the most recent birth of I can understand why your wife's not with us. You need actually professional help, not just. So who are Maxwell and Marie?
So it's Maxwell's my third name. Marie is her second name.
Ah, okay.
And so we kind of had that. I've kind of through that, we've been able to help not only with fundraising, we help with coaching with fundraising, but I've launched other brands I've launched a company called goodbookkeeping.com, which helps nonprofits with their bookkeeping. Because one of the things people ask me, how did you do it? You grew to tens of millions revenue. And I was like, I understood my numbers. I mean, my number two was a former CFO of the 13th largest company in the UK. And so our numbers were, not only was I good at telling stories, but what most nonprofits don't realize is their finances are telling a story too. And they have to narrate those through their 990s, through how they get a nonprofit just recently come to us. They lost $1 million donor because of their charity commission, their charity navigator score.
I've heard things like that. Also, just disclosing finances to donors when you're in donor conversations.
Yeah.
Just sharing what the numbers are like, but even if it's a hard reality.
Yeah. I mean,
even more so if it's a hard reality that you want your investors to be aware of that this is a down year. You've had a couple of down years.
Yeah.
But the mission is still important. The team is still outstanding.
That
the giving has not been there, and here's what we're doing to turn things around. And part of that is having this conversation with you.
It's absolutely true. One of my favorite conversations with a donor, Tony, was a guy that founded a very, very large car rental company, right? He said to me, Ben, I'm just wondering why this year's finances don't look as strong as last year's. That's because every time I meet with you, you only give me 10,000. If you gave me 100,000, it would change it. He went quiet.
Did he up his giving?
Oh, yeah, of course he did. I was
Yeah. And how about Nashville, Tennessee? How did you land there from, I don't know, where are you from in UK?
I'm from a little town called Yarm. I moved to Manchester, which was where my headquarters was. But I actually took over a non-profit in, I've built this thing called the seven pillars of a sustainable non-profit, right? And it goes through the seven income streams that you need, right? Once you get to 10 million, you can do something called merger and acquisitions, right? And so I started doing merger and acquisitions. One of the ones was in Nashville, Tennessee. And so I knew Nashville when COVID happened. I thought, let's move here. And I am a massive fan of America. So like, I know British people are going to hate me right now, but I'm telling you right now, America is where it's at. And I love it. And the business environment. I love the people and I love the culture. I just think it's amazing. It's not small thinking.
Outstanding. So you've been here just what, 5-6 years?
Yeah. But I've worked here since 2013.
What about the hat collection behind you? Listeners, you don't have the benefit of the video, but Ben has, I don't know, 6, 8, 10 hats hanging on the wall behind him.
Yeah.
This is his Zoom background. My Zoom background is this sign that says professional Zoom background, which is put on with painter's tape, and I've written in the word professional, and I didn't leave enough space, that's my background.
Yeah.
There. But what's the hat collection?
Well, it's just because I've got a really pretty wife that just wears beautiful hats. So it's a very sudden, she's American. So it's a very sudden thing to have lots of hats on, like cowboy. No, I don't think they're quite the cowgirl hats,
maybe
aren't they?
Maybe one is like a cowgirl hat. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, they're wider brims and flatter brims. All right. So these are your wife. Does she wear them? Or they're just,
she wears them. Yeah. Oh, yeah, okay. Definitely. She wears, she's got the kind of the southern charm. It's mildly annoying to her, really, because they'll often say, if we're in a drive-thru, they'll say, oh my gosh, I love your accent, and then they go, are you from there too? And she's like, no, I'm not. And she and they're like almost disappointed. They're like, oh right, you're just one of us.
She's just got a flat southern. Where's she from? What state is she from?
Well, she's a Navy brat, so she's from everywhere.
Everywhere. All right. So she does not have she doesn't even have a southern accent. Yeah.
No, she doesn't. She just has what I would call a standard American accent. But she started a nonprofit in Uganda, and she runs an organization that actually is brilliant, because it's the only organization in the world that faces this one issue. A neglected tropical disease called jiggers. And so she has about 80 staff out in Uganda that remove jiggers from people's feet and then make shoes for them. So she's made 360,000 pairs of shoes in the last 5 years for children in
outstanding Africa. What's the name of the organization? Shout it out.
It's called Soul Hope. SOLEHOPE.
Soul, like a soul of a shoe. Right, Soul Hope.
Yeah, right. She's way better at marketing than me. She's the genius at it.
Let's talk about your coaching. You do a lot of coaching of CEOs, maybe other C-suite as well, but about major donor conversations. I was kind of alluding to it when I was talking about individual conversations, investment types of conversations, not necessarily high net worth. Let's not focus on high net worth individuals, but major donors, maybe they give it to $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 level, $20,000, maybe, but they're not necessarily high net worth. They're just enormously generous. What's your advice around those one-on-one conversations?
Well, number one is have them. Don't avoid it.
Don't be afraid of them. Don't be afraid.
Because Look, I mean, I think this is really important to tell, is that they are wanting something from the relationship too, right? And if you can figure that out, you know, I talked about success to significance. Often the people that are in that point, you know, I'm part of this organization called Halftime, which was started by a guy called Bob Buford.
Sorry, it's called, say it again.
Halftime.
Halftime.
Yeah. And it's basically to help leaders that have done something with their life figure out why it all happened and how to make sense of it and, you know, what to do with it and how to steward that success to significance. And I think where, for me, is number one, make sure you make available the time. And by the way, you probably have more capacity for those relationships than you think. I mean, I had 14 direct reports. I had 12 countries. I had hundreds of staff, hundreds and hundreds of staff in my organization. But I still managed 80 relationships that were my significant relationships. Some of them, it all depends on where they were in this. I didn't just categorize them as like, this person's a billionaire, so he's my friend. And now, you know, I've grown the charity and the nonprofit larger, these people drop off and I'm going to palm them off. It was actually born out of relationship. And, but number one, you can probably manage more than you think you can, right? And number two is, they don't mind you kind of scheduling things. Like, so for example, they know if you're going to run this well, hey, they're going to touch base with me once a month just to give me an update personally or a text. But where you get really good results is that you go beyond the organization into actually being a form of friend for them. And that you check in with them. Look, I say this to my team often, right? That a lot of people that have the ability to drop 5,000, 10,000, they're in leadership somewhere on the spectrum or ownership of a business. And often that means that they're isolated, right? Mm-hmm. And they don't have people to talk to. And so these sorts of connections that you can do are mega. I'll give you one example. So I used to try and meet up with coffee. I used to text people. I used to write to them. I used to do, meet for lunch. I always used to pay, by the way. I never used to let them pay because a lot of the high net worth individuals that I would, or, you know, major donors or whatever the terminology of that. When I was a small charity and I did it out of my basement, someone who gave me $500 was a high net worth individual to me. Do you know what I mean? So the definitions change. But I used to write to this one guy, right? He was someone I was trying to approach. I met him once and I said, I want to be friends with this guy as well as I'd love him to support. He came from wealth, but he started his own company from scratch. And I set up a Google alert to watch whenever his business got mentioned or had any success. And I used to write him a handwritten card.
Very smart, yeah.
And I said, well done. I'm really proud of you for this achievement. He never responded. I did it for 7 years and he never responded to a text, a phone call, or anything. And
I admire your commitment. I doing it for 7 years and not getting a reply, you kept it up. Okay.
7 years. Well, he was on the, wasn't just because he was on the up and up. I knew at one point in time, this guy would need me. Cause I know these people are, I don't mean this in a self-inflated way. I don't hear that. Don't hear that. I just knew me and him could, when our first interaction, I knew we had something that we could be friends with. And 7 years later, he phoned me up and we're best of friends. And his business is over $1 billion revenue, but like he is just such a good human being and he's given tremendous amounts to charity. But it took 7 years of persistence that he knew I wasn't just a I had integrity in it. And I firmly believed in him. I thought he was going to do great things with his life, and he did.
Let's talk more about these relationships. Stewarding them, managing them. So you're committed to them. I would call them professional friends.
Yeah.
I mean, you're treating them as friends, but there is a professional relationship to it. You can be helpful to them in their mm-hmm. giving. They can be helpful to you through their giving, maybe through their companies. That's how I would characterize it. But let's talk more about that. You know, what advice you give your CEOs for managing these relationships?
So, I mean, this is one of the major things that I do with my life right now is I sit with chief executives and I tactically go through it with them, right?
Yeah.
And I have a team that does this because, number one, they're all unique. You know, and you've got to do some research on the individuals, find out what their giving factors are, what motivates them. But my number one thing is this, is I would not ask them all the time. In fact, I probably got to a point where I would ask them every couple of years, maybe, potentially, to give. Because what I didn't want to do was to make it transactional. Mm. I would make it an authentic friendship. And then where I would get them involved is that I would invite them to do a challenge with me. So a challenge that I raised, I think over $1 million in the early stages of when, like, that was probably double my revenue, right? Was I built these relationships and I invited them to do a challenge with me because I was like, we're friends. Let's do something together that it gets you excited, me excited, and also gets more people engaged, right, in the mission. And so we rescued a girl that was trafficked from Latvia to Southampton, England. And so I got them involved in the conversation, include them in the conversation. So there was a group of five of us. One of them was a major celebrity in the UK. One of them was a high net worth individual. And we were going, like, this girl was trafficked from Latvia to Southampton. What could we do to raise money so that we could name one of our new locations after her? Because one of the things that I did was every location was named after one of the people that we rescued or we helped, right? So the first one that came out into Bradford, England, was called Emma's Hub after the first girl that we rescued called Emma. The second one that we were going to launch was Zoe's Hub after Zoe, who was trafficked from life. So we were discussing, how are we going to do this? So number one, be inclusive, right? Don't just tell them what you need. Actually, don't just do push down leadership. Actually, invite them in to problem solve with you, right? So I was like, we need to raise $1 million. How are we going to do it? And so one of them around the table said, I know what we should do. We should do a marathon. And I was like, no, marathons are from the devil, bro. Right. And so like one of them was like, hey, we should do a cake sale. And I was like, we're not going to raise $1 million from a cake sale, bro. And then one of us had an idea. We should cycle from Latvia to Southampton. And I was like, yes, right? So at that point in time, I've got to say to your listeners, right? I thought Latvia was next to France, right? Now, if you want to get out on that, it's not next to France. No, it's next to Russia. It's 2,715 kilometers.
Yeah, it's one of the Balkans.
2,000 miles away, right? By that time, this is back in 2015, I guess. So one of the celebrity that had hundreds and hundreds of thousands of followers, like, literally just tweeted out, we're doing this, right? We're gonna cycle from Latvia to Southampton, right? The next week, before we'd even arranged how we were gonna do it, we were on national news, national in the UK, right? So this momentum was building, and there's nothing like, I want to say this, this is a side note. If you're taking notes, remember, note takers are history makers, right? Momentum is what you need to demonstrate, right? In America particularly, people give to what is successful and is moving forward. If it feels stagnant and it feels like you're losing all the time, please, sir, can I have some more? That's Oliver Twist, right? But they end up going, oh, man, I don't want to be given to these people. I want to be given to things that are successful. I want to give something that has momentum. So you need to be a great narrator of momentum. We're going to be doing this. So this challenge was our momentum builder. We had over 115 people join us on this cycle, right? We cycled from Latvia all the way through Latvia, all the way through Lithuania. I didn't even like cycling. I hated cycling, right? But we had major companies sponsor us. We were on like radio shows, TV shows. By the time that we got to England, we were doing two conferences in a day, cycling, and then getting off, doing sometimes 130 miles, getting off, speaking at a conference, cycling again, speaking at another conference. The momentum was insane, right? But that's what got high net worth individuals involved, where they were writing big checks, because they weren't just feeling, oh my gosh, they want money from me. They wanted to be included. They wanted to be part of the story, and they wanted to feel the momentum of doing something with their life. So, yes, meet them for coffee. Yes, give them updates. Yes, tell them about your need, but include them in the problem of your nonprofit and get them to do something with their life, their skill, their passion for it. And guess what happened because of that? Then lots of people heard about us. Our database grew, and that people were like, this is a fun charity. So then a few years later, we cycled from Cambodia to Vietnam. And I had, I think it was 40 people fly out and do it with us. It was amazing. Make it fun, right? There's a reason why there's fun at the beginning of fundraising. And this is really important. If you're a leader of a nonprofit, right, I just want you to know this. Right? I don't know if you've ever seen Winnie the Pooh, right? But no one in the history of ever wanted to follow Eeyore, right? Oh, we'll never change. Oh my gosh, it sucks to be, it's so hard. Nonprofits, the governments are changing that. We're never going to be, all I wanted to do was change a life, but it's just poor me. Now, they don't want to follow that guy. They're following Scott Harris, that's done charity water, that's told them that they can do extraordinary things with their life. They're following Gary Haugen from IJM, that's actually talking about how do we mend fractured, broken justice systems, and we can do something extraordinary. People want passion in their life, and they want to be told they're doing a good job, they're having a significant part to play, and they're celebrated all the way through it.
I wish we could get guests who were more enthusiastic, you know, more passionate, more interesting. I'm sorry we struck the bottom here with Ben Cooley. No, I mean, it's amazing. All right, there's brilliance buried in all that passion. I wish you could see his arms are flailing. He has to keep fixing his hair because it's falling on his face because he's moving around so much. Ben Cooley. Outstanding. I admire your enthusiasm, your passion, and the valuable advice you bring to listeners. So thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
CEO of Maxwell & Marie. You'll find Maxwell & Marie at maxwellandmarie.co. Connect with Ben on LinkedIn. I already sent you a connection request. I hope you're not going to refuse it.
Will not.
No, thank you. And it was a real pleasure. What a great way to kick off the week, too. We're recording on a Monday. Thank you so much, Ben.
God bless you. Thank you.
Next week, monthly giving with Dana Snyder.
Indeed. Dana Snyder was supposed to be this week. Yep. That's a host. I wouldn't say quite a host mistake. It just so happened that Ben came in quicker than Dana. Dana will indeed be next week.
If you missed any part of this week's show,
I beseech you, find it at tonymartinetti.com.
Our creative producer is Claire Meyerhoff. I'm your associate producer, Kate Martinetti. The show's social media is by Susan Chavez. Mark Silverman is our web guy, and this music is by Scott Stein.
Thank you for that affirmation, Scotty. Be with us next week for Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Go out and be great.